Good evening, everyone. This is Andrew Burdick. It is Friday, December the 18th, 2020. I'm talking to my good friend, Dave West. We are remotely together, but physically separate in the town of Niskayuna, New York. Good evening, Dave.
Good evening, my friend.
Great to be talking with you. So the subject we picked for tonight's discussion is lessons learned and stories about our grandparents. So I think you might have wanted to start off with just growing up with them.
Well, that's probably a good fundamental background, I guess, since I was actually I spent more time with my maternal grandparents than with probably anyone growing up. That would be a fair assessment. You know, my grandparents had a great deal of influence on my character development. My grandparents were instrumental in teaching me a lot about what it meant to be who I am, I guess. And, you know, they were experienced in some hardships of their day that had shaped their lives. And I heard about these things repetitively. And my grandfather was very adamant that his oldest grandson, me, should not be, I don't know what's the right way to say it, but should not repeat his mistakes. So should learn some lessons from his experience. Maybe that's the way to put it. So he tried to get me some of his experience pounded into my thick head as a kid. You know, he lived through the Great Depression and went through the Oklahoma Dust Bowl and, you know, all the trials and tribulations of those things. You know, he would say, you know, no matter what you do, learn some trades, get some tools, learn how to use them. That's how he would put it. Because someday money may not be worth a damn thing. A wheelbarrow of it won't buy you a loaf of bread. But just by helping your neighbor, you may be able to put food on the table. So learn how to do things and help your neighbors always, because you never know when they can help you. It's that simple. Always help your neighbor and they can always help you. It's got to be that way. And don't be afraid to help somebody and don't ask for anything back, because it'll come back to you. And he was just adamant about that. He didn't have to get paid up front immediately. It was kind of an old school way of looking at things, and some people scoffed at it, but you know, he was very clear that, you know, knowing how to do things with your hands would make things work for you in your future endeavors. And, you know, getting the skills required sometimes having the right tools. Don't be afraid of spending a little bit of money to have the right tools so you can do something that you wanted to do. So that's the road that I embarked on as a young man. You know, if I saw somebody doing something that I didn't know how to do, I went to took the effort to find out what it was they were doing. And if it really was something that I wanted to learn, I found out. And if it was a tool that was required, I would buy a tool, even a used one. And that's how I got my tool collection. Sometimes I bartered for it. Sometimes I bought brand new ones if I couldn't find a good used one. Sometimes I apprenticed myself or just hung around with somebody until they took me in and showed me. So I became part of the scene of sometimes an operation ongoing, building something or doing something that was going on. And, you know, my grandfather was right. You know, you get things back by putting things in. You know, that was very insightful of him. And that's the way I've lived my life. That's the way that I try to still be. That's volunteerism is what the, I guess, the current language, the current term for it is. But it's not something that's new to me. I've been volunteering or helping people for as long as I've been aware of being able to do that kind of thing. If you see a need for somebody to do something for them, you don't stint yourself or them, you just do it. And it's, you know, it's a beautiful thing connecting with people that way.
Right.
And it's with no expectation of getting paid back, but having them pay it forward type of thing.
Yeah.
A lot of times they want or insist upon paying you, or, you know, and that's fine. I mean, if that's what they wish to do. And, you know, sometimes you need the money to pay for expenses or whatever. There's nothing wrong with that. But that isn't the only reason you do it. And, you know, that directly connects with my desire to start the Repair Cafe. And a lot of like-minded and like-spirited people got involved with Repair Cafe, and you are one of them. That just understand this feeling, this camaraderie, you know, this whole idea of, you know, what's right with doing things for others.
Yeah. Definitely.
And, you know, that's one thing that a lesson learned. One of the biggest and most important lessons of my life.
Yeah, I can see that as being integral to your whole methodology and way of being as an actor in the world.
Yeah, I think it was fundamental. But, you know, my grandmother was also very instrumental in giving me some insights to other things. You know, she was half Cherokee and only 4'11". And she was very, very people smart. And she was very wise about people, and she would just, you know, hang back and say nothing. And then when she did, it was, you know, very to the point.
Very incisive.
And, you know, that was an interesting. She wasn't like a lot of the other women that were in my life as a kid. She, just a different kind of person. But she was always busy, and she never, ever complained. She was just busy and resourceful. And she took wonderful care of the family. And she was a fierce defender of the family. And, you know, never a doubt entered anybody's mind, you know, what her priorities were.
Right.
But she just never had to say it that much. It was just a different kind of, she didn't overdo it.
Right. But I'm guessing those things manifest a lot in your daily life.
I hope, but that would be for someone else to judge. Hopefully I will get judged properly, but that's a different story, obviously. But, you know, my grandmother also had a lot of culinary skills, a lot of things that, you know, homemaking skills, but she wasn't afraid of showing a boy how to do these things. And a boy was bold enough to ask, and I was.
Mm.
And, you know, the fact that it didn't bother me and it didn't bother her. I got to learn things that were not traditionally taught to boys. So I learned how to darn. I learned how to knit. I learned how to sew. I, you know, learned these skills. I learned how to, you know, clean and prep vegetables and that kind of stuff. Because I could help my grandmother, who I could see was totally overwhelmed by the amount of work that she had.
Hmm.
And I find those skills useful to this day. Because I find myself saying, well, what would grandma do? And, you know, lo and behold, somewhere back there in my head is that little tidbit of information about how grandma would handle that. It's stored there. I just have to go reach back in the dark archives of that little bit of information. And yes, that's the way. Because, you know, there's some weird things that are stored back there. Because she would, you know, take, you know, the hens in the hen house would produce more eggs than we could consume. So she'd oil the eggs and put them in sawdust. And then 6 months later, the eggs were still fresh enough to eat. And it's like, people don't believe you now if you tell them about that, but she'd just take, you know, vegetable oil, I think it was, but she'd oil the eggs and stick them in a old barrel that she had with sawdust in it, and the eggs would be preserved because it would keep the air, I think, out of the shell.
Right. Yeah, I've heard that several foods can keep pretty well as long as you can keep the air out of them, like butter and stuff.
Yeah, but you know, how did she know? I don't know. You know, it worked.
Right. Yeah. Something so elegant to do that, though, is definitely makes you wonder.
Yeah. Well, it's just, you know, I love, you know, lying on the floor and looking up underneath her old Singer sewing machine and all the machinery going to its mechanical dance as she was sewing something. And that was one of my earlier memories of mechanical marvels. And then, you know, when something were to be jammed up, I'd watch that machine go through its paces so many times. All I'd have to do is lie there under it when she was saying it wasn't working right, and I could see where it was not working.
Wow.
I said, oh. And I didn't have any tools, but I could borrow a butter knife. And the screws were all flat head screws. And I got to the point where I eventually got better tools, but I remember the first time I took it apart, I guess I ruined the butter knife for being a butter knife anymore. But I took the machine apart to the point where I could get the. She had been sewing a big, heavy pair of heavy jeans or something, and anyway, I took it apart, put it back together, and got it working properly with improvised tools by watching it work before and then watching it not working the way it was supposed to, and then, you know, using my grandfather's idea of, you know, learn how to do something, get the tools, and that. So I must admit that I helped my grandmother more than it was really likely, but it was fun. I enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm sure.
And, you know, it was just one of the things that made life pleasurable. You know, my grandfather was a very frugal gentleman. I think I told you before, his nickname was Timothy Titus Tightwad Pete.
Right.
He had a reason for that, but he didn't want to spend money. That was basically it. But he had some logic behind that, too. And one of the things that we were told was we couldn't buy a new nail because there were plenty of good nails out in the used lumber pile back behind the barn. It wasn't really a barn. It was like a, well, it was, you know, the barn for whatever purpose. So, yeah, we would be told to, you know, if we wanted to knock anything together, you know, we had all this used lumber and all these used nails. We could make anything we wanted to, anything we could imagine. And we just, you know, didn't need to waste any money on new nails. And if we could drive a used nail, we'd be better carpenters for it. And he was right. So what we'd have to do is we'd have to take the used nails out of the old lumber and straighten them first. And you can't beat cold iron. You have to heat it first. So you take, you know, the nails, heat them up, pound them up on an anvil, and straighten them out. And now they've got character. The nails are going to hold better. But it does take a better carpenter to drive a nail with character, because that nail doesn't want to go the way that you think it is going to go. It's not like a brand new slick nail that'll go in with just the least bit of effort. You have to hit it with finesse. Yeah, or you can cheat. You can drill a hole, and it'll follow the hole that you drill.
Naturally.
Yeah, you know, you can cheat if you want to. But still, he had a great idea, you know. So we learned how to straighten out those old, sometimes even rusty nails, get rid of the rust, get them all straightened up. And we could build anything we wanted to. So we built forts and tree houses, and you just have no idea. We had no idea what we were building sometimes until we built it. And, you know, we built boats, and you know, we whittle things. Oh, we had pocket knives. So we'd take all the scraps and whittle them into something, and sometimes it just got burned up because all it was firewood when we got done, kindling.
Right.
But, you know, we learned a lot through our efforts. And so there was a method to his madness. And that was just my maternal grandparents. I had more grandparents than most folks, simply because I was adopted a couple of times. Now, my biological father actually adopted me after the first divorce. He took me back in when I was, I don't know, 17. I was in high school when I went back living with him for a year. So I had his name again at one point. I was born with his name, and then I had his name again later in life. It's kind of strange.
Yeah.
But I got to know my biological grandparents on my father's side. And that was interesting. I went to live with them. My paternal grandparents were kind enough to let me live with them when I was going to college, because they lived in the little town where the college was located, and it saved me some tuition. I mean, some room and board. I mean, it saved me some money on the dormitory.
Right.
But it also saved me some money because my grandmother was best friends with the woman who was in charge of the cafeteria. So she helped me get a job so I could work some of the, I mean, I didn't have any financial aid, and I paid for my own tuition and board and everything. I had to pay my way through college. So it was all on me, every dime. So the work that I did in the cafeteria was basically showing up in there every morning at 5 a.m. and I made the donuts.
Right. Yeah. I've heard about this.
Yeah. And, you know, this is Oregon, and, you know, the school was OTI, Oregon Technical Institute. Now it's called Oregon Institute of Technology. They changed the name, but most of the students there were on the GI Bill. And as you can imagine, being most of them ex-military, a lot of them had a fondness for the food they had grown accustomed to in the military commissaries around the world. So the donut guy was me, and I had to make sometimes 30, 40 dozen donuts in the morning. Because that was the big seller. So we had this contraption that looked like Rube Goldberg could have designed it. It had 20 gallons of hot oil that was in this big, huge hot oil vat. It had a chain drive paddle system that went through it in this big pot that hung over it that you poured the batter into, and it plopped perfect rings into this big vat of hot oil that was 425 degrees of hot oil. And the chain drive paddles would pull these little rings of perfect donut batter from one end of this machine to the other. The tank or the vat was probably 6 feet long. And, you know, the chain drive would flop the donuts over halfway through so they'd be cooked on both sides. And then at the end, it would drop them out of a little chute, and they would drain, and all the extra oil would go back into the vat or the tank. It was quite a mechanism, and it's been there forever, and nobody knew much about it except that it worked. You turn it on an hour before you started making donuts, and it got hot, and you poured the batter in, and you know, just let it go. And the more batter you put in, the more donuts came out.
Right.
Wonderful machine. Until one day, it stuck. And so what does Dumb Dave do? He fixes it.
All right.
Yeah. So, okay. You know, I've got, you know, I limited resource of tools, you know, not many, but there's hardly any way to get to the back side of the machine where the chain drive is. So I grab a hold of this machine, which is full of the 425 degree hot oil, and I pull on this thing. It's several hundred pounds, to say the least, and it's been there for years and hasn't moved. So needless to say, when it finally budges, it comes all of a sudden, and several gallons of this hot oil sloshes over the edge of the tank, right on me.
Wow.
And instantly fries the pants I'm wearing into the meat of my legs. And that was kind of painful.
Kind of.
Third degree burns. Yeah. So fortunately, I remembered first aid 101, you know, for burns, ice. And right in front of all of the kitchen ladies, you know, three or four older women who were working in the kitchen at that time, I went right over to the ice machine and got a scoop and just dumped a couple of scoops of ice right down my pants. They thought it was hilarious.
That's just being resourceful, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was the only thing I could think to do.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to save, you know, some skin. Well, it didn't work because when I pulled my pants down, there was some skin that was fried onto the pants and they came off. But still, the scars were kind of interesting for a while.
Sure.
But I got the damn machine working. And I finished the Vilnet run.
That day?
Damn right.
Nice. You truly earned the title of Donut Guy.
I wasn't going to give up just because I got burned. The pain was, you know, going to hit me a lot harder later. I didn't know that. But still, you know, I had ice in my pants, and that was making it feel better.
Yes.
So there was resourceful, and then there's stupid. I got the damn thing fixed.
Right.
But, you know, there's crazy, and then there's look in the mirror, stupid. Yeah, that was me. But that was only a part of my experience at OTI. My grandfather was the head water master, or was the water master of the canal system there.
Wow. What did that entail?
Well, there's... in Klamath Falls, Oregon, which is where OTI is situated, they grow a lot of spuds, potatoes. The spud farmers rely upon flood irrigation. So the water rights are closely monitored by all of the farmers, and everybody gets so many acre feet of water per year out of the Klamath Lake. And there's a large canal called the A Canal, and then there's the B and the C Canal. And these canals are basically man-made waterways that divert water out of the lake into all of the fields where the potatoes are grown by the flood irrigation system. And all they do is they go out and they open up the floodgates and let the water go into these ditches, which are hand dug or machine dug, depending on the size of them, to let the water flow into the potato plants. And it's quite effective, and then they grow, you know, tons and tons of spuds, which is apparently a very productive way of growing potatoes. I mean, I'm no farmer, so I just know that that's not how it worked, and that was his job, and he was given this home to live in at the junction of the A and the B canal, which is where the water master lived. And Kingsley Air Force Base is one of the Air Force bases in Oregon, and it's in Klamath Falls, and one of the main runways for Kingsley Air Force Base is aimed right at the house. So if you know, you are sitting in the backyard in a summer night and they have an airplane taking off, it flies right over the house and you can watch, and it's kind of interesting. But if they're playing war games and they scramble a flight of jets and they all hit the afterburners at the same time, just as they happen to clear the end of the runway, you're looking down the throat of several rather large afterburners right over the top of the house. Or if there's a B-52 taking off, that's pretty spectacular.
Yeah. Ooh-ee.
But, you know, that's, you know, part of the landscape, I guess.
Right.
But, you know, Grandpa Jack was one of many, many children. That generation, I think there weren't that many. That particular branch of the family is the one that had homesteaded in eastern Oregon in 1847. And they came on the Oregon Trail all the way from Missouri. I think it was Missouri, it was St. Louis, yeah, on the Oregon Trail. And they had an oxen pulled a Conestoga wagon. But that grandmother, I have forgotten what, I was told what her name was. Anyway, she had 21 kids.
Well,
they homesteaded a little 640 acre patch of scrub that was given to them for the efforts. What was called a donation land claim. Back in the days when, you know, for the effort of improving the land, what they call proving the land, a donation land claim was how the settlers were enticed to make that arduous journey to settle the pioneer the land. So they had a 640 acres they could have gotten a deed to if they had been able to improve the land enough to meet the standards of the government in those days. So they needed to have a workforce. So apparently having 21 kids was part of the plan.
Yes.
So that was, you know, pretty impressive. So Grandpa Jack took me out there on horseback one time when we were out elk hunting. You know, he borrowed some horses from his brother Tab. And we went for quite a long trek on horseback, well off of any beaten path. It was a two-day ride way back in the well, you might have gotten back there with a four-wheel drive, but it was much better on horseback. Yeah, we had a fun trip, just him and I. And he took me back in there and showed me the old site of the old homestead. And there were places where you could see where they painstakingly gathered natural rocks up and formed a foundation for the barn and the house and a well. You know, they just piled up the loose rocks and made the foundations. All the wood that they had burned down or rotted, but the rocks, of course, hadn't changed.
Right.
And it was pretty impressive what they'd done. I mean, not much else was visible, but that Grandpa could find it, you know, that was pretty impressive too.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunately, they didn't succeed in meeting the improvement standards because of the lack of water.
Mm.
You know, they were trying to have a working ranch, but they didn't have any luck with that because they couldn't improve it well enough to raise livestock, and they couldn't raise a garden, so they had to bring everything in to survive.
Okay.
So they kept on having, you know, crop failures, and, you know, it was just not a sustainable lifestyle. They gave it a good go. I mean, they were there for like 30 years, but it went back to the Department of the Interior. So it's now under Bureau of Land Management control.
Still to this day?
Yeah.
You know? Okay.
Which is kind of sad. They put a lot of effort into it. They just didn't get lucky with the claim that they tried to make. I mean, they had a spring, but the spring dried up.
Mm.
And without water, what are you going to do?
Not a whole lot.
No. not going to last. Eastern Oregon is pretty arid.
Interesting.
Very, very thirsty land.
It's because of like a mountain range or something?
The elevation there would have been about 4,800 feet, which is higher than the tallest peak in the Adirondacks.
Right.
And the soil is volcanic. So it would have been rather hard to keep water in the soil. Whatever water hit the ground was going to go deep into it. The surface water wouldn't last long.
Got it. No table sitting around.
No water table. The water table would have probably been, the water table would have been deep.
Got it.
So they would have had to dig I think the well they dug, he had told me, was like 60 feet deep. And they lost a couple of hands digging it.
Oh, a couple of people?
Yes.
Yes. Well, yeah, that's something that gives you pause to think a little bit, you know.
Yeah. Why they went that deep, and maybe that's how they. I don't know. I mean, that's only hearsay, as far as I'm concerned, because it doesn't seem like it would have to be that deep. But maybe they were trying to go deep enough that it would be sustainable.
Yeah.
A lot of unknowns and unconfirms and a lot of I don't knows on that one.
Right. A lot of unknowables.
Unknowables, unfathomables. I mean, like, with today's technology, you wouldn't have to even worry about it. But in 1847, 1846, was 1850 even?
Right.
With manual labor and at best any kind of draft animals that you could put to use with whatever technology you had, I don't know that they had a lot of choice. They probably had to go deeper than, I mean, whatever they did, it just didn't work.
Right.
So there you have it. But they gave it a good shot, I guess.
Guess that's all you can do.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
That's for sure. And one of my other sets of grandparents, if you want to. I mean, I don't really have much. I mean, adopted grandparents, folks that I did know, and they were the grandparent generation of one of my adopted families. Were millwrights. The grandfather was. A millwright in a sawmill.
Okay.
And he and his brother were the first two to develop a flat bottom riverboat that became the prototype flat bottom riverboat that is ubiquitous now for the Mackenzie River and Rogue River flat bottom river boats that are famous for the guide boats.
Hmm. To guide like barges or something?
No, these are for guide boats for fly fishermen for fishing. What they did is they wanted to make the biggest damn boat they could out of a single sheet of plywood. But oh. You got to remember that they worked in a plywood plant that had the singular distinction of making 8 by 16 foot sheets of marine grade plywood.
Okay.
So how big is an 8 by 16 sheet of plywood? That's pretty damn big.
Right.
And it can be cut up a lot of different ways. And the standard size is 4 by 16. And that's the size they ended up with. But, you know, they press it at 8 by 16. Or no, 5 by 16. I'm sorry, 5 by 16. 5 by 16 is what comes out of the press. Anyway, they came up with a way to make a boat out of a single standard sheet of plywood. And that was the bottom. I'm sorry. Trying to get the story the way Grandpa told me. How did they do it? Yeah, it was one sheet for the bottom, and one sheet became the two sides. So they cut it. They cut one piece in half, lengthways.
Hmm.
Then they made that. I don't know if you've ever seen a Rogue River boat or a Mackenzie River boat.
I have not.
Oh, if you ever had, you'd recognize their very distinctive curved bow and stern, which are very high, very wide in the middle, like 5 feet.
Mm.
5 foot beam, and then you know they've got the gunnels are probably 7 feet across, and you know they are made big, wide, and flat. The whole idea of a guide boat that big is to have a huge amount of displacement so they can float through the roughest water imaginable. You know what the classifications are for white water?
Is it 1 through 4?
1 through 4, 1 through 5, you know, five. Okay. Being like, well, 1 through 4 will do. I think there is a class 5 rapid.
Right.
But class 4 is, you don't want to go through it unless you are an expert and you're in a boat made for it. But, you know, Mackenzie River boat being piloted by a Mackenzie River boat guide, somebody who knows their business, can go through class 4 and not get a drop of water on the inside.
Oh, wow. Okay. I just imaged hers, and I think I found it. Yeah. Sure enough.
Yeah. So these two guys did this on a whim. They wanted to come up with a way to get, because they lived in Springfield, Oregon. And they worked at the Weyerhaeuser plants in Springfield, Oregon, which was one of the first places to have the capacity to make this particular plywood. You know, the quarter inch marine grade solid core plywood, which was used to make the, the boat that was known in terms that you might be familiar with, PT.
Okay.
The patrol boat that was famous for, I think it was, well, it doesn't matter. We won't go with that story. But anyway, the plywood is just super durable because of the glue and the lamination process. And the laminate is hand-selected for strength because they use only old-growth Doug fir.
Okay.
And they laminate it up nice and tight with no voids and absolute perfect seams. So this stuff is, like, incredibly strong. And when you use that for the hull of the boat, it doesn't need to have a lot of thickness because it's got such immense strength.
Got it.
And then they made this thing, and it was so incredibly strong, but also incredibly light. It could float through a couple of inches of water with three guys in the boat.
Wow.
And with a pair of 14-foot oars, midships, you know, with one guy rowing, you know, that one person knowing what they were doing, he could scull the boat just basically using the oars, you know, very gently. Even with the boat being in the middle of a good flow of current coming down the stream, you could keep the boat absolutely stationary exactly where you wanted it in the middle of a flow of water while a fisherman stood perfectly stationary and cast a fly and catch fish.
Standing in the boat.
Standing in the boat.
Wow.
Because the boat had a nice wide beam. And
right.
So you were able to take your clients if you were a, well, this is later, I mean, after they've perfected it, able to take somebody out in the boat. And with one guy, you know, managing the behavior of the boat in the current and the other guy fishing, you could go into some really great fishing territory. And there are some great fish in the Mackenzie and in the Rogue Rivers that are almost inaccessible. Well, they are inaccessible from the shore. But getting out there with a fly pole in the middle of the water and, you know, going through some of those class 2, 3, and 4 waters, incredible. Yeah. And taking a ride, one of those things, without even fishing, is worth the trip.
I mean,
it's an incredible thing. Just believe me, I've done it. Going down the Mackenzie in an inner tube is scary as hell.
Mm.
But, you know, going down in a Mackenzie riverboat with the boat under total control is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But, you know, these guys were pretty awesome. They came up with this idea. Anyway, Harry Papa, this is the grandfather of that particular adopted brand of grandfather. Harry Papa was the millwright. He also made a lot of chainsaw blades or chainsaw bars into knife blades.
Hmm.
Yeah, he would take a bit of good steel like that and reformulate it into something useful after the, you know, the chainsaw bar I shouldn't say blade, bar, has got to have a groove going clear around it for the chain to go in.
Mm.
And after that groove has been worn out, then what do you do with it? Well, this big piece of steel, it's got a lot of use in it.
Mm.
So you take it and make a big knife or two.
Yeah.
I've got a knife in my knife rack in the house here that's a really nice. It's a not a stainless steel. It's a carbon steel, but it can sharpen up nice. And it's one of my favorite knives.
Yeah. That sounds super neat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Tell you what, Dave, we've gone pretty long, so
okay.
I think we're going to wrap it up for tonight.
I think that's a wise idea. It's 9 o'clock.
Right, and you got to get your sleep so you can reprise your holiday role tomorrow.
Yeah, I got to do that.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
I hope this was a good one.
We'll have to see what the people say.
Yeah.
Obligatory internet joke. Like, comment, and subscribe, everybody.
Comment and subscribe. Oh, yes.
All right.
Well, thank you.